Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, water, not GM foods, are the answer to Africa's hunger. That according to South Africa's cardinal. Bridging the gap between the deaf and those who can hear. If you're listening to this program, you're already one step in the right direction. And the Vatican reaches out to the world of art, opening up the dialogue to improve the relationship. World leaders attending the UN's Food Security Summit this month in Rome rejected a UN call to commit $44 billion annually for agricultural development in poor nations. Catholic aid agencies are saying that's a recipe for prolonged global hunger. Well, I caught up with South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier to ask him, what is the answer to hunger in Africa? Is it a global handout?
I think there are some emergency situations where there's no option but to exercise the charity of handing out what is necessary. But I think there are more long-term solutions that need to be put in place. And if you look at the countries that are worst affected by the hunger and so on, most of them are unstable for one reason or another. There's political instability, and one has to ask the question is why that instability is being allowed to endure. For instance, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, a very fertile place, but there are people that are starving there, but it's mainly because of the conflict that's ongoing and never seems to be ending. And one has to ask the question, is this being allowed to happen so that the mineral resources of that part of Africa can be exploited without government getting what is due to them and the people therefore having the resources for their development? Another area that's very badly affected by hunger is that part of Kenya that's been having drought after drought after drought. There are parts of Kenya, Tanzania, that are in severe drought state. Now, they obviously need emergency assistance there. But I think what the world community really needs to help Africa with is the provision of water. Giving them GMOs and all that kind of stuff may look like a solution. But if they had the water and the water was properly farmed, if I may use that term, then they would be able to grow the crops that they normally grow. And many of these crops are quite adapted to the African conditions. So with water, people would be able to feed themselves much better than they're able at the moment.
And a warm thanks there to South African Cardinal Wilfred Napier. You've probably seen them before, animatedly gesticulating with their hands and mouthing words, but emitting few sounds. Theirs is the silent world of deafness, a secret and mysterious world to most of us who can hear. They look and act like everybody else, except when they don't turn around when you call out their name. So, sometimes deaf people are looked upon as being strange, different, not quite normal.
I have to admit that I struggle with it, and I thank God for the opportunity to just pray some of those frustrations away.
No, Nicole Clark isn't deaf. She can hear just like those of you listening to this program. She's frustrated, though, because she sees how the deaf, or people seen as being different, are often treated, how they can be stigmatized, ostracized, and sometimes ridiculed. Nicole, the official sign translator for the Archdiocese of Sydney, Australia, has dedicated her life to being a bridge between the deaf and those who can hear.
I think God very specifically gave me the ability to hear because I'm probably not patient enough to be a deaf person because I see the exclusion and the oppression and I find it quite overwhelming. And I have learnt so much from a deaf person's ability to be patient and to just live with the exclusion. But I think it's a responsibility of all of those who have encountered both parts of living, the part of the world that can hear and the part of the world that can't. It's our responsibility to enlighten. I often say you can't criticise someone for being ignorant, but after they're no longer ignorant, arrogance is certainly a challenge.
Arrogance out of ignorance is a challenge, one that is likely to grow unless people start getting to know their deaf neighbor, colleague, or classmate. The World Health Organization estimates that some 280 million people worldwide have moderate to profound hearing loss in both ears. And the numbers are growing, thanks to longer life expectancies and a growing global population. Speaking of the difficulties deaf people face, Pope Benedict said there's a lingering culture today of real prejudice and discrimination against them. These are deplorable and unjustifiable attitudes, he said, because they are contrary to respect for the dignity of the non-hearing person and his or her full social integration. Well, Mara Buckley from Ireland is one of the some 1.3 million Catholic faithful who are deaf. Through her translator, Veronica, she told me of some of the challenges she and other deaf people face in society today. Be patient during the pauses. That's Mara speaking to us through sign language.
The challenges are access, lack of access to information, access to the general communication in the church, in public places, and without interpreters we are lost.
How do you think that the Catholic Church can improve its ministry to deaf people?
Learn about deaf people, get information about deaf people, have deaf awareness, understand their language, culture, and so on. Make them feel as if they're not very different, that they're just like us. The only thing they cannot do is hear. They're like hearing people, and when they have access to communication, you do not see the difference. And include them. Make deaf people feel that they are one of them. Include them.
In an effort to include deaf people and the hearing impaired in ever new ways, the Vatican recently held an international conference on ministry to the deaf called EFFATA, a command to open up or open one's ears to God and to possibilities. Well, Liverpool's Archbishop Patrick Kelly was one of the organizers of the event. He's also president of the International Catholic Foundation for the Service of Deaf Persons.
One of the gifts of St. Paul was to describe us as a body. And he said, in this body, every single member is indispensable. And the point of the image was, curiously, not primarily our unity, but our diversity. And the eye can't say to the ear, I don't need you. The head can't say to the feet, I don't need you. And St. Paul even said, the weakest members are indispensable. Now, we are only a healthy society when that is the reality. For example, a restaurant. We like mood music and dark colours, but that means deaf people can't communicate in a restaurant. My sister has hearing loss, and she says when she goes to any place where there's background music, which is almost everywhere, she said, my head is spinning, because I then cannot hear what anybody's saying. And even in church, one of the examples I give when we're designing a church, make sure the light is evenly spread so that you don't cast shadows across faces, because the faces and the lips must be seen. So we must always be learning.
I was shocked to learn that 80% of deaf or hearing impaired people live in low and middle income countries. Pope Benedict lays the blame on the lack of appropriate policies and legislation, and on the difficulty in accessing primary health care. Deafness, in fact, is often a consequence of illnesses that are easily curable. Sometimes it's simply a question of nutrition. But Archbishop Kelly suspects that the high incidence of deafness in developing nations reflects a dark side of wealthy countries.
There's one very sad reason. There can be screening, and babies in the womb who are found to run the risk of being deaf in many richer countries will be aborted. I know a lady who was told she was expecting twins who would be deaf, and she was asked to go and see a specialist, and she thought to help her to bring them up and educate them, and found the specialist was to enable her to end the pregnancy. And she, being a nurse and a strong lady, said, may I repeat, I'm expecting babies, and expecting means I'm waiting for. The irony is, she said, and when I gave birth to my two sons, They were not deaf, in fact. In fact, they became leading choristers of a cathedral choir. But you can see the message that if you're not perfect, then our society said, well, do we really need you? That may be one of the factors.
What can the Universal Church do, for example, in areas where there's a lack of funding, in Africa, in the Middle East? How can the church help to see a continuing education for deaf people, for deaf children particularly, so they can be inserted as full members of the church community?
I think, first of all, lessons from history. What now has been accomplished, for example, in the United States or in my own country, it began in very small ways. It began with somehow people who, their hearts, the great phrase, effleta, were opened to this particular group of people, because somebody once put it this way: you can see the white stick of the blind person, you can see the wheelchair, you cannot see the deafness, so it tends to be forgotten. I think, therefore, if people are beginning, let them not lose heart. But the second thing, the whole question of funding is a massively complex issue on all sorts of levels across the world and in the church today. But I do believe one absolutely central issue of the church's priority is where there is an opportunity to open up hearts and minds to the gospel, while we do things like building wells because there's no water and all these things, yes, fine, but we're sent to bring the good news, and therefore the emphasis on authentic catechesis, schooling, for me is absolutely central.
You mentioned earlier this church should be thinking about even just the lighting in a church, how to get the deaf population involved.
That's right.
So what else can the church do to allow these people to be more a part of the congregation?
One thing which some parishes in Liverpool, where I serve as Archbishop, just one or two, have now taught the congregation to use sign language. So when deaf people come, the whole congregation knows how to do the responses in sign language.
You're kidding. And, no, that's quite amazing.
And it is wonderful to see. And some of the schools now, they teach all children authentic sign language. One of the problems is there is around this thing called Makaton, which is a pseudo sign language. It's not, quite rightly, let's just say, American sign language is as different, let's just the example, as different from British sign language as, say, Italian would be from English. They are languages in their own right, and therefore people often say, why can't you all get one sign language? Which their answer is quite generally, well, when the rest of the world decides to speak one language, we'll do the same. That's where this awful, I don't know what it is, you will do what we want you to do, whereas there are cultural profound differences. One of them, and sorry we're on radio, not television, I can show, but in England, the sign for the Son of God is only used for the Son of God, not for the son of anybody else. And it's a sign where the hand starts at the heart of the person signing. And as far as we know, it arose because the first priest to try to do it was pondering St. John's Gospel, the Son who is nearest the Father's heart, the Son who's in the bosom of the Father has made God known. So there are wonderful little gifts like that which we mustn't lose.
What can we learn from the deaf?
I learnt to receive the Gospels using my eyes, and I realised that our Lord himself was a man who used his eyes. Nearly all his stories, when you look again, are about watching and seeing. He was so observant. And whether it matters, I don't know. I happened to read when I was beginning this marvellous gift of sharing this life, I read two books, one about William Shakespeare, one about Charles Dickens, and it happened, both authors made the same point: the secret of their writing was they looked and observed, not that they listened or had imaginations. It wasn't imagination, it was their sheer power of observation. They say Shakespeare's latest plays are full of the images of the Forest of Arden, where he played as a little boy. He used his eyes, so we should do the same.
Not only do you use your eyes, but you also are using your fantasy in a certain sense. You've created a new word, which is rather difficult to spell, yes. Rather very difficult to sign.
Yes, yes.
So please explain it to us.
Well, I don't like the word spiritual because it suggests that somehow what really matters is up and away from flesh and time and the things we can see around us. And so my word is patri-pneumo-psychosomatic. So
you can't even pronounce it,
myself. No, patri-pneumo-psychosomatic. Psychosomatic we're used to. We're used to the idea that things that affect us emotionally are often linked with chemical imbalance. We know that the life force, the adrenaline, all that is very intimately connected with our chemistry. And we don't separate them. You try to pull them apart and you end up in trouble. But then when I add the word in pneumo, it's from the Greek word for spirit. But in this sense, I mean the ability to relate to the other as other. And one of the wonders we say is that we don't only have adrenaline. We don't only have a physical body. The marvellous thing is that all can become a means by which we relate to others. We go beyond ourselves. Somebody once said we're all eccentric. We're all out of the centre. And that's the next stage. And I often say that the wonder of the life of the world to come, the resurrectional life of the world to come, it will wear. And today we've had with us this marvellous priest, Father Cyril Axelrod, who is blind as well as deaf. When he meets me in heaven, I'll recognise him at once. He'll have taken home the whole of his story, and the difference will be, at long last, we will both know how fully to communicate with each other. It's not that the past will be forgotten. And the other bit of the word, patri, is the Greek word for father, that the whole of this bodiliness, this adrenaline, this relating to others, comes to a wonderful climax in our relating to the Father, and therefore to everybody in the whole church. A useful word, stronger than spiritual, I think.
Well, I'm not going to even attempt to repeat Archbishop Kelly's newly coined and very complicated word. I'll sum up, though, with the words of Pope Benedict, who invites us to embrace the deaf and hearing impaired as true members of the Church's family. And he's challenging them to be active participants and real evangelizers in their communities. The Pope described today's society as suffering from a deafness of the spirit, which he says raises ever higher barriers to the voices of God and of neighbor, especially the cry for help from the least ones and those who suffer, and which encloses man in a profound and corrosive egoism. Jesus wanted to give face to a new humanity, a humanity of listening and of the word, of dialogue, of communication, of communion with God, the Pope said. And this new humanity must be without discrimination, without exclusions, so that the world will be truly for all a field of genuine fraternity. They came from all around the world, some simply out of curiosity, others for the honor. Pope Benedict XVI had invited some of the world's most prominent artists, designers, writers, musicians, and filmmakers to the Sistine Chapel for a meeting of minds. The Pope began with an invitation to all artists to friendship, dialogue, and cooperation, something that art historian Elizabeth Lev says has been the signature of centuries of church history.
Well, to start out with, this pope is an artist himself, right? The pianist pope, which we have heard about from the beginning of his election, and we know about his life, is like King David himself, his quiet moments with his piano. And so he does have a tremendous affinity for art of all sorts, between literature and music, and of course the fine arts of painting, sculpture, and architecture. And a great many of the things that that Pope Benedict XVI has been doing, in one way or another, trickle back into the art world. His interest in the liturgy, for example, one of the things we've seen him consistently interested in is the whole question of the liturgy. We see as if he's rummaging in the old boxes in the attic to find some of the older liturgical robes and objects. But in the notion of the liturgy, we confront ourselves with the sacred space. And that brings us right back to architecture. And here in Rome, of 900 churches, we certainly have quite a few examples of church architecture. Once we start to think about church architecture, the next question becomes that of church decoration. And how do we fill this sacred space? And how do we enhance this sacred space through images? And so on and so forth. So this is a very natural, very, very old thing in the church.
Though the cooperation between art, architecture, and the church is an old and natural thing, it doesn't mean they've always seen eye to eye.
I believe art and religion have taken two very diverse paths. And despite something of a valiant attempt on the part of Pope Paul VI in the 1970s, and despite John Paul II's very warm and welcoming letters to artists, his welcoming of artists, he himself a playwright, that art continues to move in a completely different direction than that of the church, to the point where, in many ways, art is very antagonistic towards the church. If you look at many of the contemporary artists, if you consider cinema as an art form, a great deal of the literature that's produced, it is profoundly hostile to the church, which is an unnatural state of affairs.
To the church, to the Catholic Church, or to Christianity?
I think you can take all three. In this case, we're talking about the Pope, so the primary concern is the Catholic Church. Then we get to the question of Christianity in general. You know, all Christians are offended when people use a cross, as desecrating a cross, and call it art. There's no facet of the Christian religion that thinks this is a good idea. It's a universal offense. But in particular, the Catholic Church being this long-standing artistic institution, we find a particular irreverence, disrespect towards the Catholic Church in most great art forms, in all the great art forms today. So in true Christian form, the church reaches out a hand and says, maybe we could talk about this. Maybe we have things in common. We love beauty, do we not? We love human expression, do we not? Perhaps there is a way that we can put in a dialogue. But this is a dialogue between people between whom there is an abyss right now.
Now, you just touched on it briefly, but here in this start of the third millennium, we've seen these examples of religion being exploited for political ends, really, sometimes using art as the means of communication, of communicating this political message. I'm thinking, for example, of the damning Dutch cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that outraged the Muslim world, and you mentioned also offensive depictions of Jesus or even of the Pope. But is there a point when art ceases to be art?
Well, that brings us into the realm of philosophy of aesthetics, and at which point this becomes a big open debate, one that the art world has been having for most of the 20th century and now into the 21st century. What constitutes art? What doesn't constitute art? Today, the concept of what is art is so nebulous and so undefined. It's connected merely to a recognized genius of an individual as opposed to any kind of formal, structural, ideal, objective standard. And so I would steer clear of that question on any kind of, if you will, ecumenical dialogue between the church and art.
Sacred art and the decoration of churches were put into question by the Protestant Reformation. Do you see that as a period which is long gone? Do you think Christianity is over that issue?
I love that question. And I just start with a little note that it's a debate I always put on among my students every year. In my Baroque class, I have two students argue for and two against church decoration. I always find it the most interesting of the projects I give all year, and everybody has an opinion and everyone gets involved. This is not a new question. It wasn't actually brought up by the Protestants. It was a question that was brought to the fore in the iconoclast controversy during the course of the 8th century, when the Eastern Church eradicated images and the Western Church embraced them. We find it happening even earlier when Gregory the Great has to weigh in against the Bishop of Marseille, who's been destroying images. This is a question the Christians had in the catacombs when they first wondered, is it appropriate to make images in these spaces? So the Church for many, many years has confronted cycles and moments of is church imagery a good thing or a bad thing? Is excessive church imagery distracting, too worldly, or is it helpful towards the people? The Church has consistently, from the time of the early catacomb painting through the Counter-Reformation, and I truly hope now in the 21st century, the Church has consistently affirmed the good of images. And in the Council of Trent, the meeting of December 4th, 1563, the last of the meetings, they extolled the virtues of art in churches so that the faithful get in the habit of remembering, and that looking at the saints and their example will order their lives in order to be more like the saints. And they also reminded us of the necessity to constantly remember the acts of Christ for our salvation. And so it always boils down to a very good way to help people remember not only Christ's tremendous actions towards mankind, but also that there are men and women all around us who have been exemplary, have led exemplary lives. So the question of art in churches, I believe, is a very, very lively, very interesting one, and one that really has to be, once again, hashed out in this period with why are we putting it in and what is it supposed to do?
At a time when more and more people seem to be questioning the relevancy of God in today's world, where do you see art and religion going from here into the third millennium?
Well, again, people have done a lot of questioning in the 2,000 years of Christianity. And many, many times, art has been a very helpful way to assist people to understand the questions and the doubts and the frustrations and the confusion they feel is normal and part of the human experience. And I think of artists like Caravaggio, who showed up in the midst of a tumultuous, incredibly difficult era in 1580 and gave us these vivid pictures of people who looked just like the viewers. The viewers looked at identical copies of themselves, struggling in environments that looked just like their own homes or their local restaurants, and struggling with this light and dark within themselves. And so art has a wonderful way when you find the right artist and you find the right patronage and you're able to infuse the art with the theology and the theology with the art in such a way that we can look at it and feel that we are part of a great experience and that we too can do it. In many ways, you would expect the art form to respond to that call today would be cinema, and it has made a few truly valiant efforts. But unfortunately, cinema most of the time spends its energy denigrating and ridiculing the church, when indeed it's another art form that could, in fact, glorify the stories of the saints.
So you're saying the Catholic Church perhaps should get more involved in producing films.
I'm saying there's actually a lot of interesting stuff going on right now with some great directors starting to tackle religious stories, not unlike Chagall, Matisse, and others in the 1950s, after they'd done every single pagan subject matter possible, they turned their attention to Christian subjects. And as it just so happens, there are several directors and producers, after a lifetime of paganism, seem to be turning their attention to Christian subjects.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University. I'm Tracy McClure. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.